Centennial Observance, and who is the pastor of our parish in Park City, and Sister Lorraine Masters, who directs our outreach to the Native Americans, to the Hmong, and is also our liaison to the Black Catholic community. I have passed around some copies of the California's document. You may need to share some of those, but I will summarize it for you in my presentation. I have to say to begin with that I am thinking a little bit of the what happens when headlines go awry, and the Salt Lake Council of Churches had a headline yesterday that says, "Ministers oppose prayer on theological reasons." And I thought very much glad that was not a headline I had to own. Well, we're going to deal with that kind of document today. To begin with, however, I would like to give you some definitions. And then if you have questions as I go along, you're welcome to ask them. But I will make about a 15 to 20 minute presentation, as will Father Fitzgerald and Sister Lorraine, and we will leave the whole last half hour open for your questions and dialogue. To begin with, I'm assuming that there are very few people here who are cognizant of Catholic language and terminology, so I better do a definition of terms. We talk a lot about dioceses. A diocese is a local church or a community of faith gathered around its bishop. So here in Utah, the whole state of Utah is one diocese, the Diocese of Salt Lake City. That's also the case in Idaho, the Diocese of Boise, or in Wyoming, the Diocese of Cheyenne, where the whole state encompasses one diocese. But in larger, more populated states, generally there are clusters of dioceses or a number of dioceses, and generally even in large cities become what we call archdioceses. Well, in those larger states where there are clusters of dioceses, maybe 5, 10, 15, even 20, the coordinating of the diocese's efforts to interact in the political arena or in the social arena is complicated if every bishop does his own thing. So they cluster into what is called a conference. So you might have the California Conference or the Texas Conference or the Michigan Conference. And what that means is the Michigan Conference of the bishops of that state and their respective dioceses working together in a collaborative effort to make a statement or an impact in the political arena as lobbyists. There is on the national level what we call the USCC, United States Catholic Conference, which is all the bishops of the United States working in concert in one joint conference. Now, of specific importance to us today is the lower, or Baja, and the upper, or Alta California Commission. The California bishops, in their conference, work very closely, as part of their work, with the Mexican bishops in the northwest part of Mexico, which is Baja California. And they together, that is the Mexican conference, so to speak, and the California conference, worked together in their commission on evangelization. And so this document that we are going to be addressing comes out of this subcommittee of the California conference in concert with the Mexican bishops. Now I want to tell you a little bit about the genesis of this document. It was formed by a joint committee on evangelization. And this is what I'm going to tell you is what I have pieced together in my checking on the background on this. So you're not going to read this anywhere. And this is a biased version. But my understanding is that joint committee was doing nothing. It was just kind of sitting there, getting nowhere. So Bishop Maher of San Diego suggested an agenda for them, that they take on proselytism. Well, they did, and they began to meet and work on that, and numerous drafts were developed. And remember that each draft was done bilingually because of the both in Mexico and in California. Interestingly, as all of those drafts went through their revisions, we were never consulted here in the Diocese of Salt Lake. Well, the last draft of that, after the commission finished it, got sent to the California bishops for distribution with a target date of release of February 28, 1990. Now, I'm not exactly sure when that was sent up to the California conference, but my sense is that it was sent up early, so a number of months, maybe even a year or more, and it was sent up there, and the bishops of the conference were to review it and make their comments and approve it before it would be released. Well, it slept up there for a long time until one very alert staffer saw that its release date was February 28th, which was Ash Wednesday for Catholics, and released it. And what we ended up with is a document that is theologically weak, this is my opinion, whining in tone, and poorly prepared. And its impromptu release caught the usually professional California conference off guard. And to my mind, I think it became for them a source of some embarrassment. At least that was the sense we were getting when we tried to find out what was going on. With that background, let me tell you what the document says. Part of this will be objective, and part of this will just tell you what the document says. There is an introduction. And in the introduction, they make a very valuable and interesting distinction between proselytism and evangelization. Now, proselytism comes from the Greek word about approaching newcomers, and it has taken on, in the modern world, a pejorative or negative context, and it certainly has that definition in the document. So, it defines proselytism as the use of unfair and coercive practices and methods, that is to say, those which apply pressure to convince a person to leave his or her religion and join another. It defines evangelization, which comes from the Greek word about proclaiming the gospel or good news, as giving witness to God as revealed through Jesus Christ in the Holy Spirit in a simple and direct manner. So two distinctions. Negatively, proselytism, positively, evangelization. Now, this document is addressed to three groups of people: to Catholic leaders, to the Hispanic peoples, and to proselytizing sects. The next thing it does, you will find offensive. It distinguishes between historical churches and sects. And it defines historical churches basically as mainline Christianity, including Catholicism and Orthodoxy and the Protestant churches which emerge at the time of the Reformation. It has an interesting definition for sects or new religious groups. It defines those as those founded in the past century which reject or directly oppose the historical churches. We refer especially to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormons, Jehovah Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, Pentecostals, in a variety of forms, and others. Then they begin to try to explain why Catholics join sects. They give three reasons that they call external, but I don't think they're really external, and three reasons that they call internal. The reasons that they give externally is our what they call bad ecumenism on our part. Ecumenism is the drive of the church toward unity. And what they are saying is that we as Catholics have so conditioned our people to tolerance and openness to people of other faiths that they're like sitting ducks for proselytizing sects. The second thing, which I think would be a very valuable insight, is the church's option for the poor. And if you are unaware of that, the Catholic Church considers as primary that we opt for identification with the poor at all times. Now, I think what they're trying to say is that as a result of our decision to be among the poor, who are very, very disenfranchised and often very marginalized, that we have become dissociated with the establishment, and the establishment, therefore, likes to call in safe religions to combat Catholicism, which is often a threat, they see, to their governments. Now, I'm postulating that, because I know that's true, but unfortunately, this paragraph isn't a complete sentence in the document. Or if it is, there's a they, and we don't know who the they are. The third thing that they say is an external thing is that these people, these sects, have a great deal of money, and especially because they're coming from developed countries, have lots of money to spend to try to get people. Now, internally, the reasons that people leave the Catholic Church, according to the document, is first our lack of pastoral care, that we aren't taking care of our folk. The second thing is that our folk are overemphasizing their ritualistic worship and not attending to their personal relationship with God, and therefore, when they see their faith merely in ritualistic terms, they can think that's all that Catholicism is about, and then when they have alternatives, they leave their faith. And the third reason they give is what we would call clericalism, that is, that the Catholic Church has not effectively involved all of our people in the living and directing of our church. Now, then they go through a section of doctrinal principles, and I have to tell you that this is very confusing. But the bottom line is simply two things. The first thing is they, after they go through some Bible quoting, end up saying that the sects confuse what I will call cultural Catholics, that is, Catholics who are immersed in the culture of our faith. They know the celebrations, they know the great ritual moments, they live those kinds of things, but they're not intimately involved in a parish community, and they don't regularly attend services and so forth. Those kind of folk, the sects tend to think, are unchurched, and this document challenges that. Secondly, it would suggest that the sects are prone to telling baptized Catholics that they're going to go to hell if they don't get themselves baptized the way, according to a new definition of baptism, and become believers. All right, so then they give some guidelines for action. And this is what they would like to see us do. First, a renewal of faith. That sounds pretty good. That we begin to revitalize the deepest dimensions of our faith and our heritage among our people. The second thing is the realization that we must have smaller Christian communities. As you may be aware, Catholic parishes can get upwards of 40, 50,000 people parish in Latin American countries. We need to be sensitive to what we in America call minorities, and they specifically talk about the existing pastoral plan for Hispanics. In other words, as a church, we have a plan for reaching out to our people who are often marginalized and disenfranchised. We need to follow it. They suggest that we have better knowledge of various sects of faith, so we know what the sects are teaching, what their tactics are, and what their materials are. That will allow us to counter them better. You'll get a kick out of the next one. They suggest door-to-door visitation. They suggest an outreach to the rural areas and to the poor who are the most vulnerable to proselytism. And they suggest that in the many opportunities we have to give missions and teach our people in homilies and catechesis, that we instruct our people about the dangers of proselytizing sects. And finally, the last thing we should do is pray. Now, then the next section is an invitation for those who are Catholic and have left their church to return. And then it closes with an admonition to proselytizing sects. And they would make three suggestions to people who belong to proselytizing sects. The first is that they would encourage Catholics, that proselytizing sects would encourage Catholics to learn more about their own faith rather than be confused with controversial ideas. Second, that that proselytizing sects consider carefully the damage that they do when the culture and religious heritage of peoples is ignored. And finally, they ask for a greater spirit of mutual understanding between faiths instead of condemnation. That's pretty much what the document says. Now, immediately upon release, we got inundated with lots of requests about what do we here in Utah think about that document. And if you have one of the sheets on the sidebar there, you'll see Bishop Wiegand's statement. And I have additional copies of that if you'd like. Bishop Wiegand basically said four things. The first he said thing is, taking their definition of proselytizing, he said, we all have to be concerned with unfair and coercive practices and methods, since those kinds of things compromise the reputation of religious groups. The second thing he reminded us is that this document is rooted in the Baja California experience. So it is not binding on us. It may have ripple effects over here, but it's a California document. The third thing he said is that the document does, however, challenge us, and I think he means you and me, and this is an excellent forum, to begin discussing the abuses of proselytizing, especially those that are occurring among the poor. And finally, he says that our experience here in Utah is not necessarily the experience in California. Now, I'd like to close and ask Father Fitzgerald to speak about what evangelization is all about and what, as a church in Utah, we are doing about evangelization. And then I'm going to ask Sister Lorraine to talk about what happens when people are abused by proselytizing experiences. But before I conclude, I would like to say that I have shared with you this afternoon at some risk. It is not that I've risked my own biases, and it's not that I risk misunderstanding of a document that is obviously flawed. The risk is that you will hear the whining tone of the document and laugh at its weak theology and its poor grammar. The risk is that you will become complacent by Bishop Wiegand's mollifying words. And the risk is that you will write off this document as unimportant and unimpressive and valueless, and in so doing, miss the profound cry of pain which brought it forth. The risk is that you will miss the kernel of truth that none of us want to hear. Father Fitzgerald?
Thank you. Happy to be with you this afternoon. I'm to speak a little about the Catholic sense of evangelization, what we mean. And I think it's a very nuanced experience, and so I would like to approach that by kind of describing my own Utah experience. I'm reminded of the story of the fellow who went out on Saturday night, and he had too much to drink, a lot too much to drink. And the next morning, Sunday, church time, his wife was trying to drag him out of bed to go to church. And he was moaning and groaning with his headache. And he said, no, you go to church, you pray for me. So pretty soon she was getting ready and getting the kids ready, and as she was going out the door, he said, come back. So he called her back, and there he is moaning in his bed of pain. And he says, could I get you a... don't tell God I was drinking. Maybe say I had the flu. You know, so you know, a lot kind of depends on how you say it, what you say, and what impression one wants to give. I was born and raised about 2 miles from here, right below Westminster College. And to my knowledge, we were the only Catholic family in those days in the whole area. And in fact, I went to the Emerson School down here, not too far away, and I was the only Catholic kid, I think, in 400 kids in that school, to my knowledge. And I remember well, after school, walking home, and everyone in the school would go to primary. And I would always, on that night, have to walk home alone because I had no friends. And I also would remember in the neighborhood when people would gather, go to the ward behind our house, and they would go to the movies and the dances and so on. And then I would just harass my parents, why couldn't I go, you know, to those movies and those dances and so on. And my parents would say, that's proselytizing. Those people want to get you over there and give you free popcorn and free movies and make you Mormon. And we're Catholic. You know, we don't do that. And every now and again, at least in my family they didn't. Every now and again, the Mormon missionaries or the elders would arrive at our door and want to come in and kind of share truth with us. And they usually would follow the Jehovah Witnesses who had been there a few days before. And my father would be very outraged and say, for Catholic people, religion is a private affair. We respect what you do, and we want you to respect what we do and be happy neighbors and friendly and so on. And it wasn't that we Catholics, at least in our neighborhood and in our family, were embarrassed to be known as Catholic, or that we didn't believe in spreading the good news of the gospel as we knew it, but we just weren't comfortable with the Mormon style in those days. We had our Utah Catholic newspaper that related how wonderful it was to be Catholic, and often we would take the old copies and leave them on the bus or leave them in the dentist's office by the Book of Mormon, you know, that we would find there when we went. And we had our radio program where we kind of, you know, told things like we saw it and reiterated Catholic news and said, you know, we might be a small number of Catholics in Utah, but we belong to a huge church around the world, and we're part of that. And what happens in that huge church is part of us. And to kind of perhaps affirm ourselves and build our sense of pride in our faith. But the focus for those of us who were Catholic was much more on ourselves. We felt very hesitant about being perceived as pushy or assertive about our beliefs. And each year in our parish church, a church down here by Judge Memorial, which was my parish, each year we would have a missionary come in from somewhere and would give a week-long mission, and our family would go and sit in the front pew there, the front seat every night of the mission, and this fellow would rant and rave, sometimes about hellfire and brimstone, you know, threatening us that if you didn't practice what you preach, if you didn't live well the being a Catholic, that you were going to be in for serious trouble. And you shouldn't worry about those people out there who might not be living the right way. You had to worry first about yourself. And we were encouraged to pray for especially the pagans and the people in other countries like Africa who didn't know Jesus, and to pray for our neighbors who were good people, but perhaps walking in some darkness because they didn't have the faith that we had. And of course, we would always save our pennies to send to the mission so that missionaries of the Catholic Church could teach, you might say, and the pagans and share our faith with them. And in those days, a lot of what we would call evangelization was done by priests and sisters. It was the actual mission work of the church, and pretty well designated as that. And priests and the sisters would give their lives to this mission thrust, and they would go to the foreign countries more than in the U.S., and would bear witness to the Lord by serving other people like Jesus asked of his disciples. And even here in the early days in Utah, I was reflecting, the Sisters of the Holy Cross out of St. Mary's, Notre Dame, Indiana, came here in 1875. Long before we were a diocese, long before a lot was established, and they opened Holy Cross Hospital, and the old St. Mary's of the Wasatch. And they and other groups of sisters and religious priests who came over the years, they opened the orphanage and the hospital for minors and services for unwed mothers and our Catholic social services and schools, which we still have a lot of around the state of Utah. The thrust was to be present institutionally and to serve the healing and the teaching mission of Jesus. The purpose was to teach the Christian values that we felt were important, to live out the works of mercy that Jesus spoke about in the Gospels. And this was the way we evangelized since the earliest of times, instructing the ignorant, healing the sick, regardless of religion, and trying to impact culture. And I'm sure most of you are very familiar historically with our history, clear up through the centuries of establishing monasteries and universities and patronizing the arts and music and so on. That's kind of been our way. That was evangelizing for us. And so while we Utah Catholics wore our crosses and made sure that our crosses and our religious statues were pretty visible in our homes and in our schools or our hospitals, wherever people were, we were horrified by the thought of knocking on doors in those days or giving the impression that we were intruding in any way on the private lives of people. And the assertiveness of the Mormons and the predominance of Mormons in this area, I think, made Catholics here much more sensitive to this than they were in other places. We overreacted. You know, my father saying, no, no, religion is a very private thing. We hold to ourselves. That's not quite accurate, you know. But nevertheless, that was the style of evangelizing that we picked up, some because of our theology, but some because of our experience. The Second Vatican Council came along for us, and it called us to reevaluate our openness to the world and to people of other faiths. And the council recognized and reminded us of an age-old belief of our church that there is only one baptism, and that all Christians, everyone who believes in the name of Jesus, everyone who shares baptism with his or her sisters and brothers, makes up one human family, regardless of the clothes they wear or the denominational tag that they might, with which they might label themselves. And the council reminded us that we should work together in the world to strengthen the values that we share in common, that the world was in some sense hostile, and that the best we could do for the world was to impact the lack of values in the world by all those who shared something in common, namely baptized Christians, by sharing those values and that belief in what is good, what is beautiful, and what is true. And the council made clear that it's not only the priests and the sisters who have the responsibility of building up the community of faith for the Lord, of evangelizing, but it was every person who is baptized. And the council also issued a very strong admonition, saying that in whatever we did, as we dialogued with the world, as you've been doing this week, that we respect the dignity and the freedom and the values of every person and every culture. And in 1974, in light of the teachings of the council, Pope Paul VI called a special meeting of all the Catholic bishops of the world, their representatives, and he called a synod. Well, that meeting is called a synod. And the topic was evangelization in the modern world. And a year later, Pope Paul VI summarized the dialogues and the discussions and the theological reflection of that synod. And he published a document called Evangelii Nuntiandi, pronouncing the good news, announcing the gospel to the world. And that 1975 document has become the Magna Carta for the Church as we prepare for the quincentennial, the coming of Columbus and Christian faith to the Americas. And we here in Utah are focusing on that document and that evangelization thrust as we celebrate our centennial, our 100 years as an established diocese, official church in the state of Utah. And in light of all that I've described, I want to conclude with just a few brief points to summarize theologically what I've expressed as my own experience growing up in Utah as a Catholic view of evangelization. And hopefully this gives at least some sensitivity to you in terms of where, at least in Utah, we've come from on this sensitive issue in relation to our universal church. And so as you heard Father Busson read from that document of the bishops, evangelization for us means bearing witness in a very simple and direct way to God the Father as we know him in Jesus Christ and through the ongoing inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And all these little statements are really coming from Pope Paul's document and also from a summary of that document that our bishops issued a few years ago in 1984, I believe, a vision of evangelization for the U.S. And so for us, the heart of evangelization is proclaiming salvation in Jesus Christ as a personal experience, something I have experienced and my sisters and brothers who have been baptized in faith have experienced, and our willingness to live out a response to that salvation we've experienced. And so that each of us is to proclaim the gospel message so that we can help one another be saved. And the kernel of the content there is that salvation is a gift from God. It's something God gives to us, which liberates us and frees us from anything that oppresses us, namely evil and sin. Salvation was accomplished for us once in the death and resurrection of Jesus, but it has to be continued over and over again in community relationships in our faith. And so, sharing in the evangelizing mission of the church requires of us five things. That first, we ourselves have to experience the conversion that the Lord proclaimed. Reform our lives and be faithful to the gospel. There's no room for hypocrisy or for living by a double standard. Secondly, that Catholics, first of all, have to evangelize other Catholics because we share an intimate relationship of family with them, encouraging one another to be faithful, supporting one another on the journey, and seeking reconciliation with Catholics who have some way drifted away or become apathetic in the practice of their faith. So again, it's getting our own house in order before we reach out to anyone else. And then thirdly, this conversion challenges us to reach out to people of other faiths who share baptism but who might be interested in our community Catholic way of life. And the documents tell us we do this by reflecting the joy and the peace and the good news of our own lived experience of the gospel. And this challenges us in a very unique way to an ecumenical life, that we need to see where we can share with other faiths ecumenically in the community for building up the values that we all hold dear. Jesus saying that division among Christians is a scandal. Fourthly, this conversion calls us to reach out to those who are not Christian, to those who have no religious affiliation, but acting as Jesus did, with sensitivity to their freedom, respecting their own situation, their own consciences, and their own convictions. And lastly, this authentic evangelization requires a response in justice to the needs of those who are suffering. That we need to give ourselves as Catholic people to the works of mercy, to feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, and so on. And that will be the sign as to whether the internal conversion has really taken place for us. And we're cautioned that it's never enough to distribute bread, but as important as that is, we also have to join hands with others in the world today to try to impact systems, family systems, economic systems, recreational systems, social systems, educational systems, and so on. And finally, I would conclude with this little quote from Pope Paul VI. For the Catholic, he says, evangelizing means bringing the good news into every strata of humanity so that its influence can transform humanity from within and make us a new people. The purpose of evangelization, he said, therefore, is this, to bring about an interior change in people, in the broader church community, and in the world. For when the church seeks to convert, it is merely the divine power at work and the church proclaiming that power both to individual people, their consciences, their lives, their activities, and to the environment in which we live.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here too. I bring a new dimension to this panel. I'm a missionary. Nothing unique in Utah, but to be a Catholic missionary sister is a little bit unusual. It wore out, as often did my knuckles as I used to knock on door when I went door to door in California, New Mexico, and I haven't done it in Utah, though. I'm a full-time Catholic missionary sister. I belong to a congregation of sisters who have been here in Utah since 1939, and our title is Our Lady of Victory Missionary Sisters. I've had 45 years experience, both as a home missionary in California, many, many years, New Mexico, both in cities, small towns, Indian reservations. I have also been a foreign missionary. I spent 4 years in Bolivia and loved every minute of it. I still wish, with God's grace and help, to continue my vow commitment to Jesus Christ, my church, my vocation as a baptized Christian, and as a member of my missionary congregation, to do mission and spread the kingdom of God. I believe in that challenge that was given to the Jewish people by the prophet Isaiah in the Old Testament, when he spoke of his wish, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all people." However, and this is a big however, in my 45 years experience, there is one word that has been a little bit of a red flag for me and has a very bad connotation. And I hate to say it, but it's that word proselytizing. I had a friend come to me and say, "I'm going out and do a little proselytizing." And red flags start to wave. There might be in the dictionary a fine line between the words proselytize and evangelization. But as far as I'm concerned, as a grassroots missionary, there's a wide chasm between the two. I would like to be allowed to share three examples what I feel are proselytism and what it means to me. These are all true examples that I have experienced or have known the people involved in them. There is the example of what happened to a young, beautiful, and very intelligent young woman I met from South America a number of years ago. She was one of many children from a poor but hardworking family who was strong in their faith and the practice of their religion. Because she was a go-getter, after high school she wanted to go on to college, but she could not because of her family's poverty. Therefore, when another religion offered to sponsor her college education in this country, she accepted. In this country, shortly after beginning her college education, she was confronted with two very upsetting facts. And she didn't realize this before she left her own country in South America. If she wished to continue her college education, she was told she must join the sponsoring church or her funds would be cut off. Naturally, if she refused to become a convert, since she had no outside means of support, she would soon be deported back to her own country. She was very vulnerable. She thought and prayed more often over this. Her lack of money, her separation by long distance from family and friends, her youth in inexperienced strange land, not knowing what the future would bring, and yet determined not to sacrifice either her faith or this opportunity to get an education to help her family. She ran away one evening from the home in which she was living and working as a servant. To make a long story short, she did find new friends, she did get monetary assistance, and has now completed her education in the States. Case number two. Two young Indian boys, and my ministry has been for the past 17 years with Native Americans, were attending a boarding school far from their homes and Native friends and traditions. They came from different southwestern tribes, most of whose members have been of a certain religious tradition for almost 300 years. They often came to a student center of which I was a director for the church. We became very good friends. They often asked if they could walk to church with me on Sunday mornings. One day, out of the blue, they told me they would not be coming back to our center anymore as they were joining another religion. Naturally, I asked why. Well, they had been going to the sports programs and they were going to be sent on many outings free of charge, and my limited resources could not allow any of these things in my center. Then they told me that after the sports, their friends urged them to attend the religion classes at this church. What disturbed me was when they told me what they had been hearing. The instruction in these religion classes was not about the gospel of Jesus, the study of the Bible, but it was mainly distortions of their Christian religion. Because of their youth, they had neither the maturity or the knowledge to defend their faith. Far from family and home, they were very vulnerable. And later on, I found out they had become so confused by the conflicting instructions that even their faith in Jesus Christ was weakened. The third case. A group of Asian refugees were sponsored by a church group to come to this country to begin a new life. They came with high hopes of better life in a free land. This group of refugees were not settled in individual houses, but in one large communal building by the sponsoring church. Jobs were obtained for the men, but they were still confined as a group in this building, and they were not permitted to strike out on their own. As new immigrants, not knowing the language or the ways of the dominant culture, they were totally dependent on their sponsors. Shortly after, they were pressured to join their sponsor's church, and they were told their jobs depended on their becoming converts. Shortly after this, another member of their race, who had lived in this country a few years, became acquainted with their plight. Speaking their language, he explained to them their rights in this country. He sought not only legal counsel, but financial support, as well as homes, individual homes for each family. He told them living in this country did not depend on their being members of a religion different than their own. These three examples are three in my many years of experience I have come across. Now, the church that I belong to has a long missionary experience, some 2,000 years, of carrying out the mandate of Christ to his disciples, go into the whole world and proclaim the good news to all creation. Or as Matthew says it, go therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teach them to carry out everything I have commanded you, and know that I'm with you always until the end of the world. Now Christ said he was sent, and also his disciples were sent, to bring glad tidings to the poor, to proclaim liberty to captives and release to prisoners, and announce a year of favor from the Lord. Now in this 200 years of experience, and it's been quite well recorded, so we can't deny it, we have both good and bad news. We are proud of the achievement and the memory of those missionaries throughout the centuries, since the time of Christ, who carried the good news of the gospel to every corner of the known earth, and the thousands of martyrs who gave their lives as witnesses to their faith in Christ. We are not so proud. In fact, we blush with shame and embarrassment about those members who, in their missionary zeal for what they consider to be the truth, blinded them to the rights of others and deprived them of their God-given freedom in Christ. Comes to mind, first of all, the Inquisition, and also in our treatment of Native Americans here in the States. Hopefully, we have learned from our history. Recently, I read in a home mission magazine these beautiful words, and they said, why is it that the message of Christ sometimes comes to us from sinful people? And in the Extension magazine, these words struck home. It said, the words of Christ come spoken in the mouths of sinful men and women. It would be easier had Christ chosen some other method of reaching the world, but he didn't. He chose to do it by embracing our fallen humanity. Sinners crucified Christ, and sinners now do preach his mercy. So what has our 2,000 years experience taught us? There is an authentic type of evangelization process, and one that I do not consider authentic. The Holy Bible gives us directives in what this missionary task should be. I think of Jesus. Jesus came as a child. He never forced himself on anyone in his career. In the Old Testament, there's a story of the prophet Elijah in the cave on the mountain, and God told him he was coming to him. He was going to be present to him. And the story told us first there was a great wind that wreaked havoc on the mountain. And God said, I'm not in that strong and terrible wind. So I feel we should not bring the message of Christ and try to convert others by coercive practices and methods. And we should not become our zeal blind us to becoming too militant and overbearing to those who are vulnerable. Then Elijah, as he was waiting in the cave for God to come, felt a great earthquake and experienced a great fire. And God said, I'm not in the earthquake. I'm not in the fire. So we don't make converts to our church by resorting to deliberate lies or distortions of another religion's doctrine. We do not destroy one religion in order to preach the gospel. We do not wound the soul of vulnerable people in the name of saving it. Then Elijah heard and felt the gentle breeze and the tiny whispering sound. And in this, God came to him. And so when we go to minister to other people, I think very much of this quotation that I read in the Merino Missionary Magazine. Our first task in approaching another people, another culture, another religion, is to take off our shoes. For the place we are approaching is holy. Else we may find ourselves treading on men's dreams, more serious still, we may forget that God was there before we arrived. So for me, evangelization, as an Indian priest once told me, is first an attitude. And a necessary quality of evangelization is sensitivity. Sensitive in the fact that we always respect the dignity of the other person, their status in life, their race, culture, traditions. We're treading on sacred ground where God has been before us as missionaries. We must respect another's spiritual relationship with their creator, their inner system of meaning, their religious imagery. We can evangelize someone without demolishing their anchors or the things that are precious to them. We have to avoid making rice Christians. Missionaries in China learned that this boomerangs. And you make a rice Christian when you persuade others to join your religion by offering them a monetary reward or economic advantage or a special education beyond their means and demanding they join your church. The missionaries in China found out that in times of persecution or obstacles or trials, when their rice was taken away, so too was the faith of the rice Christians. Father took the words I was going to end this by, the quotation from Pope Paul VI, that we want to transform humanity from within and make it new. But I'll take this statement from the U.S. Bishop's vision of evangelization. Authentic evangelization must include a response in justice to the needs of suffering human beings. Christ's message must be embedded not only in the hearts of people, but in social systems and cultures as well. Thank you.
Time is yours, and I'm going to simply chair your questions and comments, and I'm asked, there's a note here that I must repeat your questions for purposes of taping. But if you have a question you would like to direct to a specific panelist, please do so. The question is, within the Mormon Church, or the Mormon Church is grappling with whether to have separate groups, celebrations for ethnic groups, or to integrate them into the larger community. How do we do that within the Catholic Church? Sister, you want to tell me?
I think you have to do both. And it also has to be what the people want. I've been some places where the native people said, don't separate us from the rest. Don't make a separate church on the side and just put us off there. But also Native Americans, because they are the indigenous minority, also need a network of support. And so the Catholic Church also, especially what I'm very much involved is what is called the Tekawitha National Conference, in which we bring Catholic Indians from all over the United States and Canada, and to show them our support. We're having an ongoing dialogue between Native spirituality and Catholic spirituality, and this has been very important to the people. So I guess you have to have both, really, but they do need a network of support.
I would say yes, in this regard. Certainly the Greek roots of both words are neutral, all right? The fact of the matter is, in modern English parlance, proselytism has taken on a pejorative sense. I don't know that we do that or how that happens, but that has occurred. The document gives what I think are a number of very arbitrary definitions. And in the document, it does use proselytizing to define the negative coercive practices of religious denominations. That concept, whatever word you want to hang on it, we would say is very inappropriate. I'm going to ask Father Fitzgerald to answer it while I repeat the question. The question is whether the Catholic Church considers evangelization exclusively a Catholic domain, or whether when other churches, i.e. Mormonism, properly evangelize, do we recognize that as valid?
I think the answer is yes and no. to make real clear, I think certainly all of us proceed from the fundamental focus that we have the truth. Not that we have all the truth, or that we are the only ones who have the truth, but that you know, I personally find a substantial amount of truth in my Catholic faith, and that's the way of life I want to lead. And I feel I'll go to find my relationship most effectively with the Lord in the Catholic Church. I know all kinds of Mormon friends and Presbyterian friends and Lutheran friends who would say exactly the same thing. So I think evangelization for the Mormon, the person who becomes Mormon, is baptized, has a deep faith and an authentic belief and really lives that faith. That person has been evangelized in the Mormon tradition, and authentically so. And I think our theology, the official teaching of the church, not necessarily what every person on the corner might do, but our official teaching is we must respect that and do anything to support that, your sustenance in your faith, and that we would be violating your conscience or your culture or the environment, whatever, if we were to use means that would disturb your peace, upset you, or confuse you. So I would say, yes, you know, the answer is yes, we would appreciate that and respect that. I think that's, Paul VI was very strong on that, respecting the religious traditions of other people and their religious experience. You know, we would want you to be Catholic, you know, just like you would want us to be LDS. We're all looking to build up our own families of belief, but I think we would respect that, yeah. Sure. Oh, certainly. I guarantee you. The gentleman asks if I can guarantee that he would get to heaven, having been evangelized as a Mormon. I assure you. You know, I think in our, certainly we see that there was a time in our practice and even in our undeveloped theology, I think, where we were saying things like, you know, only in the Roman Catholic Church is there salvation. But we've come to have a much broader understanding of that, and certainly that Evangelii Nuntiandi of Paul VI says that, you know, that what that is really saying is that it is truth and fidelity to truth and living in love, you know, as disciples of the Lord, that's what gets someone into the kingdom. Not being titled Roman Catholic or LDS or anything else, so... Yeah, you'll probably be there before I will, I suppose, you know. Maybe. We all aren't that way. to repeat the question, how can I repeat that question? to summarize, lady has kind of summarized, I think, the tension that exists when people of various denominations are very committed to their point of view, and very enthusiastic about evangelizing other people to their point of view, as well as personally living that way of life. And how can we live side by side together, respect, care for one another, work together, and encourage others to join our community of faith because we are enthused about it, and yet at the same time be respectful, appreciating the gifts that other people bring. Does that sound like it? Yeah. Sure, and I, the tension, the the fears and the misunderstandings, the mistrust that exists between our denominations, between our communities. I tried to reflect that in telling the story of how I grew up around here. You know, just my family fears and stereotypes, and some true and some distorted, totally, you know. But that's the way life is, and I think there will always be those. And I think, you know, we're always, unfortunately, going to have our Iraqs and our major blow-ups and the tensions, just like we do in family, you know. Everything isn't peaceful in family. There are divorces. There are runaways. There are, you know, terrible things that happen. And there are going to be those among the larger people of the larger community. But I think the important thing is for me and for you is that we can proclaim the ideal which Jesus proclaimed in the gospel, namely that all those who are baptized in the name of Jesus share something tremendously unique in common. And that's what matters more than anything else. And we need to get on with life and make the world a better place because we share so much in common. You know, most of the values, the main essential values, and Bishop Wiegand has said this numerous times in his columns, we share, LDS and Catholics share, those fundamental values, you know, belief in goodness, beauty, righteousness, justice, doing what's correct, living faithfully, you know, to the gospel, caring about those who are without. We all share those values. The things where we disagree are lesser, I think, you know. So.
Question is about the document's definition, distinction between historical churches and sects. The Catholic Church recognizes Mormon baptism. Should I just answer that? The first thing is, I think that I would have to say that the document's definition is rather arbitrary, that historical churches are the ones we like and sects are the ones we don't. Now, I have seen better definitions of historical churches and sects, so I won't own those. Secondly, your question as to regard of Mormon validity of Mormon baptism. I'm going to have to answer that. That is very problematic in the Catholic tradition. That the Catholic Church recognizes the baptism of other Christian denominations. And the way that we generally recognize that is that if a church performs baptism, or if a person performs baptism in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, pouring or using water on that person, intending baptism, the person is baptized. According to that criterion, the LDS baptism would be valid. The problem is, the question comes, what happens when the understanding of the person baptizing of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is radically different from the understanding of the common Christian tradition? Then is the baptism still valid? And the answer is, we don't know. And the reason that we have formally decided we don't know came about through two cases. In Catholic tradition, we always take the safer course anyway. When we are dealing with people who are married or actually are divorced and seeking marriage in the Catholic Church, we have the question, well, do we recognize the baptism, say, of a Mormon who's been divorced and now wants to marry a Catholic in the Church? And the Church came back and said, take the safest course. The hardest way to do this is to consider the baptism valid, so consider it valid. All right, so when it comes to marriage, we say, yeah, we got to consider that a valid baptism. But when it came around and said, well, what about people who want to become Catholic from the Mormon tradition? Do you baptize? They said, conditionally. So that means that we, for people who want to become more Catholic, just in case, we'll baptize them under conditions. Now, what was the Church saying in those two decisions? We don't know. We can't make a decision, so let's take the safer course in both sides. And I don't know of a more formal understanding of that, but I'm beginning to hear a shift. When I was growing up, the answer would have been clearly no, Mormon baptism is not valid. I am beginning to hear increasing numbers of Catholic leaders say, yes, it is. No. No, they're not. The question is whether Catholics and Mormons collaborate in times of crisis to do outreach to people in catastrophic circumstances, right? I would say on a formal basis, here in Utah, the answer is no. But then we have not had that circumstance where we've had that. There are some interesting things happening, though. You may know that when the Ethiopian famine occurred, what happened at that time, Catholic Relief Services was there. The LDS Church decided to make a major gift or donation to the famine victims of Ethiopia. And rather than send all of their own administrative services and everything, set that all up and duplicate it in Ethiopia, they channeled the funds directly through Catholic Relief Services. So there are collaborative efforts going on in this area. The second thing that is happening is that here in the city, there are some very, very valuable and very good efforts of collaboration on the part of the LDS Church with other churches. And I know of a couple. I'll give you examples. They are efforts of the LDS Church with the Catholic Church. The first is with regard to our St. Vincent Center, with which you may be familiar, feeds the homeless down on Second South. The complete kitchen for that new building was donated by the LDS Church. Okay? Second thing is the LDS Church is collaborating with the Catholic Church in their clinics. The health clinics for the homeless are run by IHC, but in the Catholics' center. Well, are you asking, are other denominations also doing that kind of thing? Have always done, all right? It's only recently that this is a rather new development, at least as far as I know, where the LDS Church has begun to collaborate with other communities that I'm aware of, and I would love to be corrected on that.
We're still pushing too hard as LDS people.
I'm going to let Sister answer that as I repeat the question. The question is, given that LDS Church continues to have a large number of missionaries in the field, and secondly, that the general authorities have indicated a greater tolerance for other church traditions, has the situation ameliorated in the world today vis-a-vis the Mormon Church?
I take back my 45 years' experience. When I was in Bolivia, the times that I used to see the Mormon missionaries and felt much in common with them was in La Paz, when we would meet at a place where we all knew we could get some kind of a malted milk and French fries and something that looked like a hamburger. So I had that in common with them. We did find those places together. I don't know. I've been in Bolivia. I've been in California, working mostly among Hispanics. And as I said, the last 17 years, I worked mostly among Native Americans. And you'll always find individual cases because, as Father said, individual people look at the truth of their religions and in their zeal want to share it, but sometimes they share it in the wrong way. And as I said in my talk, we just have to be very, very sensitive. Evangelization is an attitude. And if we come with respect, I don't think anybody will complain about that. And if you don't go out and deliberately, and I stress the word deliberately, distort another people's doctrine, or say that they teach this or believe this and they really don't, we can be much more friendly to each other.
That's well put. And I think, you know, in our tradition, in the Catholic tradition, we in general have had a tradition of not sending people out who aren't well prepared. You know, I just returned. I say this in a, I'll clarify that in a very positive way. I just finished a six-year term as head of a Catholic seminary in the Northwest, training priests for the West. And we have an 8-year training program versus the very short, you know, period of time that training that you give to missionaries. And I personally have always felt somewhat bad for the missionaries. I've known many young missionaries who have come to talk to me and shared this and that, and it's asking a great deal of stamina and courage and emotional stability for a young missionary to go out and face the hostile world that many times they face. People aren't always nice, and it can be very heartbreaking. Their enthusiasm is wonderful, but it can be very difficult. You know, I personally like the old days when the LDS gave a much, there was more thorough training to the missionaries. It's lessened in recent years. So I think people should be prepared for what they're going into. I just want to make one other point. I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of a perspective. You have, what you said, 40,000 missionaries? Approximately 40,000 missionaries out. See, I think from a Catholic perspective, we would wish that they were out helping the poor, doing things. You know, I know in some places the LDS like have primary schools and clinics and so on, but in general you haven't done that as much. With your resources and with that power, you know, I think from our perspective we would say, man, it would be great if those 40,000 people were out helping build homes and improve water supplies in Western Samoa or wherever. We would tend to look at that and to look at just going out to knock on doors as being less sensitive to the needs of the poor where they are. But that's our point of view from evangelization. So
I'm going to ask Sister Lorraine to answer that, because I think she knows the answer, and I'll repeat the question. The question is it possible to evangelize people and other cultures without doing damage to their religious traditions and heritage?
As I said, when you have 2,000 years experience and history, you have lots of things that you're not proud of. But I'm very proud today of what we're trying to do in Native American ministry. As I said, we're having an ongoing dialogue with Native Americans who are very strong in their Native traditions and spirituality. Many people don't realize that in South Dakota, for over 5 years, the Jesuit priest and the Sioux and Lakota medicine men met regularly, once a month almost, to discuss mutual things, core values, core teachings among each other. And they found that instead of having so much that divided them, they had more that connected them. And so today in our Tekakwitha conferences, our gatherings of Catholic Indians, we always know that we sometimes have to walk carefully like on eggshells, and we have to dialogue, and we have to share, but we always say there is only one Creator. And the Creator has spoken to us differently, but there is only one Creator, and we are His children.
Question. The gentleman feels similarity with some of the things that possibly that all of us were saying, and feels some kind of an inclusive relationship in the Catholic fold as we've described it, I suppose, and would want to know how I would feel about that. Is that correct? Well, yeah. Do you tithe? But that would be the sign, you know. Where do you send your tithing? Of course, I'm kidding. I think the Catholic theological documents of recent years talk a great deal about levels of relationship with Christ in terms of denominational church, and there are those who are officially baptized, you know, and recognized so as Catholic and wear the denominational sign, whatever that might be, you know, in terms of recognition by the larger community. But there are many who belong in differing degrees by reason of acceptance of Jesus, acceptance of the values of that Jesus proclaimed. And so to that degree, yes, we're all one family. We're all Christian, and we share those values. When you get to the specific I think some of our talking here on evangelization is that large, inclusive arena of the family of Christian, where we share so much in common. And, of course, from the perspective of a Roman Catholic, the closer you get to the denominational practices, the way we express and live out our understanding of that Christian faith, you know, the closer you are to that, to those rituals and practices, the more we would identify you as being, you know, kind of public Catholic, and rather than closet Catholic, if you wanted to say it. So I think, insofar as, for example, one understands then our sacraments, you know, believes in those sacraments and feels that he or she can receive support and strength for daily life from receiving those sacraments, that would be, you know, strict denominational and very Roman Catholic, insofar as one believes in the works of mercy and living out the prescriptions of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. That too is Catholic, but it's in the broader range. So I would say we're all family in that broader range, but you would not at this point, you know, we wouldn't identify as you being ritualistically Roman Catholic and making that public proclamation. Does that kind of...
Yes, I understand that.
Yeah.
Can I add two things to that? One is the Vatican Council talks quite eloquently of what are called anonymous Christians. And those are Christians who, believers of whom we're unaware. And so it acknowledges that the phenomenon you're experiencing exists and is valid. Okay? It doesn't say of those people, well, they're not Catholic then. It calls them anonymous Christians. The second thing is that the Catholic Church has recognized that becoming Catholic is a process, often a rather long one. And it's recognized that we call that process the catechumenate. And the catechumen is considered Catholic, even though not yet baptized, much as the child within the womb is human but not yet born. So those two distinctions are very much part of our tradition. You've been very patient. I have to get your question.
Father, as a friend of Father Thomas Merriman, I shared with...
Question is, are there ongoing meetings with... The general authorities of the LDS Church between the Catholic Church? The answer is not formally, but yes. We don't go down there every week and meet with them, but we have very, very good relationships with a number of the general authorities and First Presidency of the Church. Bishop Wiegand regularly consults with them on key issues, political issues, for example, that affect us commonly. Or they will call him. So there is good channels of communication going on right now.
I just have a comment to add to that. Father Merriman is always kidding about when he's going to get served a cup of coffee.
Well, the bishop didn't get one when he went. The question was asked by Rabbi Fred Winger whether I would unpackage the comment I made about the pain underlying this document. I think that anybody who is involved in the religious arena can document abuses of proselytizing. And we know that when people are coerced, terrible, terrible things happen in their lives. An example. For example, if someone is, in a coercive manner, brought into one church, finds that they're very, very unhappy, and yet are told that they can't go back, they live in a sense of, by the church they went into, they feel lost. And what do they do? How do they go home? And they think they can't. What we find is, and I think that there's, the document is very flawed, but the... particularly the experience of the people in Mexico, where the people are poor And the people want desperately to come to a better economic life. And churches are handing out carrots saying, you become one of us and we'll get you a visa to the United States. How can they say no? And then they're ripped out of their culture, their language, their heritage, put into a new world, and then sometimes abandoned. Those are terrible abuses. Or people are brought into to a new church without any sensitivity to all that they have been for as a people, and they're told, no, you have to reject that. What that does is it fractures the fabric of a culture, of a community. And that's very, very painful. And we witness that and experience that on massive levels now, particularly in northern Mexico, but we're also, I think that is an experience in that the California bishops can sometime somewhat relate to. The pain of that people experience and that peoples, not just individuals, experience as a result of coercive practices. And we can tell the story. Huh? I'm not pointing, because we can tell the story when we, quote, evangelized, but coerced the first Native Americans in the United States. And we know what we did to that people's culture, and to the fabric of that life, of the tribes. Terrible damage done. That's the pain that is being experienced in Latin America today, and certainly in the northern part of Mexico. Does that answer it? It is 6:00. I agreed that we must end on time. We'll be here, and we'll be happy to answer any questions for you. Thank you very much.